From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Enterprise Reporter for CNN Politics. And here are the issues. Police shootings of black men prompted days of rioting in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the charging of a police officer with manslaughter in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Racial unrest over shootings and clashes between protesters and police have erupted in a number of cities across America over the past 2 years. Meanwhile, an immigrant from Afghanistan, an American citizen, was charged with bombing in a New York City neighborhood in which 29 people were injured. And on Monday evening, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will meet in their first of three nationally televised debates, lasting 90 minutes each, I believe. Well, I think we'll start with the other issues, and I'll leave time for Hillary and Trump, which I'm sure the whole world wants to hear about, but we'd be speculating on it. What about these police shootings, David? I mean, they just have recurred everywhere, and it doesn't seem to matter whether the officer, the police officer who does the shooting, is black or white. It's a question of who is the victim, the black men.
So, obviously, these shootings follow on the trail of a whole number, and essentially the problem with the reaction that seems to bubble up time and time again is that people get shot. There's often a dispute as to whether they had a gun or whether they were threatening or whether it was legitimate. But the bar to prosecute a police officer for shooting someone dead when they think they were in danger of their life is very high. So very, very often, the police officer who shoots someone, even if the police department then subsequently says it was a mistake or they were, you know, the details were not quite as they'd first thought, they're very rarely prosecuted with murder or manslaughter. So from the perception of the African-American community, you can kill black people in this country with impunity. That's the charge that we have again and again and again. And so we see this kind of recurring pattern of the family saying that the person was entirely peaceful, the police saying that maybe they had a gun or they thought they had a gun. The real driving force, I think, is that time and again, officers are not punished, because prosecutors will tell you actually the bar is very high to punish a police officer for that. Well, they have a lot of leeway.
Yeah, we saw in Baltimore where there was not a shooting of a black man, but he died after he was arrested and was carried through in a police van and so on. There were, a half a dozen police charged. None of them were convicted.
That's right. And I think the final thing I would say, as a foreigner who's been based here many years, I think one of the things that Americans sometimes kind of have got used to is this is also a very, very heavily armed country. So it's not only a dangerous place to meet an armed policeman, it's a dangerous place to be a policeman, because so many people out there do have guns. And in North Carolina, which is a conservative state that has very liberal gun laws, a huge number of people have the right to have a gun. And so if you're a police officer, it's also a very dangerous place to be a police officer. A lot of police officers shoot people in this country. A lot of police officers get shot in this country.
Stephen?
I think you're right. It's this repeating cycle, and there's no seeming way out of it. You know, there's a shooting, there's a protest, sometimes it escalates into violence, the politicians become involved, the politicians on one side, the president, for example, says something's got to be done about this, you have a sort of a counter-reaction from the politicians on the other, but it goes away, and then 3 weeks later it happens again. It doesn't seem like there's any progress in solving this. I think probably the key to it is local police forces and local communities trying to work better together, but it's one of those kind of endless parades that we see that just keep recurring and there's no way out. I think what's very interesting in the last few years on this issue is the increasing role that social media plays. You see these things now actually happening sometimes in real time on Facebook, or a video goes viral of a policeman shooting, and you have some sort of people, when they're stopped by the police now, they start their phone so they have a video of it, and the officers now, many of them have body armor with, you know, cameras and everything else. So I think that's one thing that's serving to sort of create debate about this and probably inciting some of the violence, is that people now see what's happening on TV. It's quite possible this was going on for many, many years. Right now we're actually seeing it, and we're seeing it on our TV screens. And that's one of the reasons why it's become so sort of emotive, I think.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the president has, President Obama has said anything about this, but his attorney general, Loretta Lynch, has. And I interpret what she said is, I'm not getting involved in this.
So I think the president was asked in general about this on American television.
Yep.
And said that it was important for people to debate this in a way that was peaceful, that most people debating this on both sides were taking a sort of peaceful line. He was sort of, it was a fairly generic statement. I mean, he has had to weigh in before. I think one of the fascinating things about where these latest riots in Charlotte are taking place, Charlotte is not, you know, Montgomery, Alabama. Charlotte is a success story of the new South. It's not the deep, deep South. It's a small town that's become a big financial hub. It has lots of health insurers. It has lots of
banks.
Pretty affluent, professional black people. It's a city that was priding itself on being part of the new South, this kind of success story of kind of business pouring in. So it's a real setback for them to have these images of looting and rioting on TV.
The what about the Tulsa case? Now, there, a white woman police officer shot a black man, which is another wrinkle in this. In the Charlotte case, it was, correct me if I'm wrong on this, an off-duty black police officer who had shot the victim there who was black.
Right, Stephen? And I think the police officer has been charged with manslaughter over this, so we'll see how this particular case plays out. I think there's always a dispute in these cases as well. I don't know the particular of this, the Tulsa case, but it seems like there's often a dispute which exemplifies how difficult this is, because the police officer sees one thing and the victim and the victim's family see another. I mean, it seems to be in this case of Tulsa, the guy apparently had his hands up and, you know, maybe we're going to see footage and that will change the sort of legal difficulty that you were mentioning, David, about how hard it is to prosecute police officers in this. But it's a very difficult thing, and every single case now gets blown up immediately because they're seen as, you know, the latest in a trend.
It's a big story. Now, look, we're going to talk about the debate a little later, but I do want to inject the politics here just on one question of this. Who does something like this help? Does it help a candidate like Donald Trump, who says, I'm the law and order candidate, or does it help Hillary Clinton, who has a milder approach? And anyway, David.
So I fear that the kind of the grisly political arithmetic of this is bad things happening between now and Election Day probably help Donald Trump. Why is that? I mean, Hillary Clinton needs to rally as many African-American voters as she can, but she can't say anything that is kind of infinitely comforting to them, because all she can really say is, it's complicated, we need to try and think harder about how to fix this. Donald Trump is making an authoritarian pitch to his core vote, which is white people, and particularly less educated white people. That's who the polls show is his core vote. And he can say, as he did this week, this shows that, you know, drugs are out of control, we need to take back our cities, aren't safe, we're out of control, we need to have tougher policing. He mentioned stop and frisk, which was a policy that was controversial in New York, where effectively very intensive policing, often of people, black people, Hispanic people, young men, who are seen as more likely to be committing crimes. By saying that, he whips up his base. So it's easier for him to fire up his base when bad things happen than it is for Hillary Clinton to fire up her base.
Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, it plays into this rather dark vision of a nation under siege that Donald Trump laid out during his convention speech, which some people sort of said reminded them a little bit of Richard Nixon's campaign in 72. And, you know, you had the terror attacks in New York, which mercifully no one was killed in, but and you have these police killings, which play into this idea of a nation not at ease with itself, this idea that there are lots of threats around. And Hillary Clinton's problem is she exemplifies the status quo. I mean, she has been in power or close to power for a quarter of a century. Donald Trump is the only candidate that can set himself up as the exemplar of change. We got to do something different. Hillary Clinton can't say that just because she doesn't have the credibility, because she's been you know, part of the elite for so long. So I don't know. My kind of view is that the fundamentals of this election are set and Hillary Clinton will probably win, but Donald Trump could win. I don't know how much individual episodes can change that, but it's possible that, a trend of these things getting worse and worse until Election Day could sway some swing voters.
I agree with that. Let's turn to terrorism, though. What about, you know, the peculiar thing about the case of the bombing in New York that injured 29 people, as Stephen said, didn't kill anybody, is that the FBI had investigated the person who's charged with this, an immigrant from Afghanistan, an American citizen, had gone to Pakistan, had returned to Afghanistan and so on. And when he would come back to the United States, the FBI would talk to him. And they didn't find any reason or any legal reason to not let him back in the country, which would be hard anyway because he is an American citizen.
So this, in a way, is weirdly reminiscent of the challenge that lots of European intelligence agencies face, which is you have a long-standing Muslim immigrant population, and if they radicalize on their own over the internet or through sort of, you know, becoming more extreme on their own without being a member of a conspiracy that you can try and track, these so-called lone wolf kind of attackers, pretty amateurish, pretty clumsy, and in fact, thankfully, in how he built these bombs, they're really hard to trap. So the system kind of worked, but wasn't enough. So you're right, when he came back from a trip to Afghanistan, he was there for a year, he was flagged for secondary screening, the FBI opened a dossier on him. Then his father, his own father, who runs a fast food restaurant in New Jersey, phoned the FBI and said, my son sounds like a terrorist. He's looking at all these terrorist websites. I'm worried about him. They checked him out. They checked out his connections. They couldn't find any connections because he didn't have any connections. And so ultimately, the FBI gets thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of tips like this. It can't follow all of them. So eventually it went back to the father, who said, oh, actually, maybe I, you know, exaggerated things. I overreacted. And so they dropped the case. So the system kind of was working, but isn't enough to catch every lone wolf.
Well, if he had been not an American citizen, they could have told him, take a hike. But an American citizen, I think they had to let him in, absent incriminating evidence.
That's right. To push back against Donald Trump, who immediately said this was a case of, you know, our wide open immigration policy and how we don't have good screening. This particular suspect arrived when he was 7 years old, so it's not clear how you screen a seven-year-old for how he will become when he turns middle-aged.
Stephen?
Yeah, and that's the way Donald Trump exploits this. You know, he says stuff like, well, there's something going on, we've got to be tougher. It doesn't matter, really, that the details of his plan to crack down on immigration of people from areas of the world where terrorism exists, which seems to be the latest sort of manifestation of his Muslim ban. The details don't matter. It's just this idea that this guy's been coming backwards and forwards. Something's going on. We've got to crack down. In a political sense, that's a strong enough message for what Donald Trump needs to get done.
Okay, we'll have more in just a minute. First reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. All right, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Stephen, I'll start with you. This is the first of three debates. I have some views on this, but I'll let you all talk first. I was a part of a debate. I was one of the questioners in the 1984 debate, the first one between Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale. It was the debate that Reagan lost overwhelmingly, and of course he went on to win a re-election, but I'll get back to that later. How do you all see these debates, particularly the first one seems to be the one that matters the most, Stephen?
I think so. That's traditionally been the way. I mean, I think this debate in many ways is more than a debate. It's almost a cultural moment. It's the most logic-defying presidential campaign we've seen in the modern era. There's going to be a massive television audience. We have an outsider candidate, Donald Trump, the likes of which we've never seen. So this is going to be a huge event. I think Donald Trump's task is to prove that he can be seen by any wavering voters as presidential, as someone they could trust with the presidency. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the 2000 debate between George W. Bush and Al Gore. Al Gore went into that debate being hailed as one of the great debaters of all time. George W. Bush was kind of hazy with his facts. People thought he was going to mess up and not do very well. When he didn't, he kind of subverted the expectations and people gave him more credit than perhaps he was due. I think you could argue in many ways that Gore won all three of those debates on policy, but policy doesn't always matter in debate. It's like style over substance, body language, the general impression somebody gives. So everyone is expecting Donald Trump to, you know, come into this debate to go say something crazy, his head's going to explode. If he doesn't, it's going to be difficult for Hillary Clinton because everyone's going to say, well, you know what, we expected her to do well, but he did better, and that's the way the debate will be scored.
You know, the 2000 debate is a good example. I really hadn't thought of that one, David, but where Al Gore was on offense and George W. Bush was on defense. And as you look through other debates, it's usually the person who was on offense who goes into a debate thinking, I need to win this debate, winds up losing.
That's right. And they've got totally different tasks. I mean, you know, I'm sure all of us spend a lot of time talking to voters at the moment. I spend my entire life on a plane at the moment, traveling around America, talking to voters. And if you have to sum it up, people don't like Donald Trump very much. They say, you know, I worry he might just start a war with that big mouth of his. Mm-hmm. But they don't trust Hillary Clinton very much. So that is a kind of, it's very, very hard in a debate for Hillary Clinton to address the trust issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's something she can't really fix with a debate. She can tell people how much she knows. She can tell people how competent she is. She can tell people how experienced she is. But kind of people know that. That's not their problem with her. Their problem is they don't believe a word she says.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard to fix in a debate setting. So it's kind of really, I'm inclined to guess in advance that it's a referendum on Trump. Can he prove that he's not some hothead who'll just kind of wake up in the morning and push the nuclear button? That's kind of the test.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to do much.
No, exactly. That's a very, very low bar.
He can be calm.
It's a very, very low bar.
He doesn't have to do a whole lot.
His task is a whole lot easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you saw how the media will score this when Trump went to Mexico to meet the president. So he basically stood behind a podium, read out some prepared remarks, took a couple of questions and then left. And he didn't embarrass the United States on the world stage. And people were saying, look, see, Donald Trump can be presidential. Yeah. I mean, that's how low the bar is here.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you know, debates have changed the campaign in relatively few instances. I talked about 2000. Some people think the Reagan debate in 1980, which was just before the election, settled the doubts people had of whether Ronald Reagan, you know, could handle the job of the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 2008, Barack Obama had to sort of prove that this one-term senator was able to handle the job of the presidency. So in many instances, the debates, they get a lot of oxygen. Everyone talks about them. But in the end of the day, you look at the polls and it's only a few points, apart from some exceptions.
Here's a question for you, Fred, because you've been to a lot more. I mean, I've only been covering 2004 was my first presidential election. Yours was, you know,
1976.
Right, that beats me. So here's a question for you. It would seem to me that there is one vulnerability for Trump, which is that unusually for a presidential candidate from a major party, quite a lot of his policies don't actually make any sense at all. So you take his policy that he would have taken the oil in Iraq. Mm-hmm. That was the smart thing to do after the Iraq invasion. If you ask him about that, and I have when I've interviewed him a couple of times, how many American troops would you actually have to sort of stick in Iraq to take that oil? How would you get the oil out once you've stuck those troops there? How long would you leave them there? It's a policy that makes absolutely no sense at all. It's gibberish. I don't know whether there is an opportunity for Hillary Clinton, if she can ask a question simply enough, to kind of expose some of his gibberish as gibberish.
It would have to be the moderator. She doesn't get to ask a question. She can pose one and Trump can ignore it. I mean, I agree. There are instances like that that the moderator, Lester Holt of NBC, could raise. But my watching of Trump says that you challenge him on something and he just repeats it.
Yeah.
Which he has about the oil in Iraq. The 1980 debate, though, is a very good one, Stephen, that you mentioned. Jimmy Carter was the incumbent president, and he was challenged strongly by Ronald Reagan and was on offense. And his job was to show that Reagan was an extremist and he was a warmonger or potentially and so on. And all Reagan had to do is Jimmy Carter would say something and Reagan would sort of calmly say, well, there you go again. And Reagan was very disciplined and very likable. And once again, the guy on defense, Reagan, won and Carter lost.
Right. And I was wondering, it's interesting you mentioned that phrase, there you go again, that Reagan kept saying, which became the kind of emblem of that debate.
Yes.
If there's some kind of phrase that Hillary Clinton can come up with and saying, there you go again, Donald, no details, you know, spouting your mouth off. I don't know what the phrase would be, but to kind of sort of exemplify the fact that Donald Trump, you know, says crazy stuff, doesn't back it up, doesn't seem to know an awful lot of stuff. That's one way I think the Clinton camp could turn this around. But the interesting thing is, you know, there's never been a presidential candidate with less substance that I can think of in the modern era. Even, you know, Ronald Reagan had to face that test, but he was a two-term governor of California. He was steeped in conservatism. You know, he knew how to speak to the American people. The question is, can Trump reach that bar? It's you've got to talk to the American people in the language they understand. And now Donald Trump has spoken to a certain sector of the Republican electorate. When you talk to them, people say, you know what, he says the things I think and he's got the guts to say them. The question is, can he talk to the other 60% of the United States or the 10% of undecided voters or whatever they are? Can he reach those people And I think that's going to be a very big question on Monday night.
And that is a good question. I want to refer to one debate in 1984 where I happened to be one of the questioners, not that that affected the debate at all.
Sure, added to the quality, though.
It certainly affected my career, but other than that. But Reagan came in. He had been convinced by his staff and advisors that he was just not a guy with these sweeping speeches and so on, that he needed to show that he was a detail guy, that he really knew a lot. And he tried to do that, and it was a disaster. he lost overwhelmingly, and Walter Mondale was not stressing details, and it was the best night of his career. Reagan recovered in the second debate, a little like 2012, where Obama did poorly in mm-hmm. the first debate and then recovered in the last two debates. But once again, it's something where a guy, details hurt Reagan in that debate, didn't help him.
So there's an interesting question about gender. Now, it may be that it doesn't come up at all, but we have mm-hmm. seen, so during the presidential primary debates on the Republican side, there were very few moments where any of Donald Trump's rivals really discomfited him. But one of them was when he had said sexist things about the only woman mm. on stage, Carly Fiorina.
Yes.
And she took him on mm-hmm. on that. Mm-hmm. And that left him looking sheepish and bad. We've also seen in...
Well, it was one of the few times he had to back down
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, because he'd been caught out being sort of crudely sexist. And she called him on it in mm-hmm. a rather clever, sort of neat kind of way that just shut him down.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, and I'm not predicting this is going to happen again, when Hillary Clinton was running for the Senate in New York, one of her opponents, Rick Lazio, came after her with stuff that to TV audiences looked aggressive and a bit kind of chauvinist.
Mm-hmm.
And she was quite effective at making him look like a bully. So that clearly, I'm sure if you're advising mm-hmm. Donald Trump in his inner team, they're telling him to avoid anything that feeds into that, not least because one of his big weaknesses in opinion polling is he is really doing very, very badly with certainly educated women. He's mm-hmm. losing educated white women by a huge margin compared to other Republicans in recent elections.
What can Trump do, Stephen, to appeal to women, suburban women, middle class and upper middle class women, and college-educated voters that even many Republicans seem to be a little leery of Trump? Can he do anything in this debate to win them over? I doubt it.
I mean, I think it's too far gone. There's too much mm-hmm. on the record already. I mean, he's mm-hmm. tried to unveil these proposals, which aren't very detailed, characteristically for childcare for young children, so to allow mothers to go out to work, etc., but it doesn't seem to have penetrated much. I think the best advice you could give him would be not to rise to Hillary Clinton if she tries to bait him. She mm-hmm. might try to kind of bait him into mm-hmm. some kind of response that looks mm-hmm. sexist. And one of the amazing things about this debate we've not talked about is that there's a woman on stage for the first time. We've never mm-hmm. seen that in a presidential mm-hmm. debate before. And it's amazing that this election is so tumultuous that that simple fact often escapes us.
Yeah, look, and Hillary is a good debater. She was good in debating Barack Obama in the Democratic primaries in 2008. It did, I think, much better than Bernie Sanders in the Democratic debates this year. But, you know, the question came up in the 2008 debate, and it's one that has dogged Hillary, and that is she likable? How can she be likable? And, of course, Barack Obama famously said, oh, you're likable enough.
You're likable enough. Experience is interesting. That plays to women voters. I went and did a column recently going to speak to Republican women who are not that happy about Donald Trump mm-hmm. in a suburb in Richmond, Virginia. And they said something that I hadn't thought of. It's a classic test of why you have to get on the road and go and meet real people because mm-hmm. you hear things you hadn't thought of.
Indeed.
They said they were all successful businesswomen working in a fairly male-dominated world in Southern mm-hmm. Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, every single time we want to win a contract or get a new job, we have to be 10 times better qualified than the guy on the other side of the table from us. So the idea that Trump, who has, in their view, no qualifications, could imagine he could swan in and get this job mm-hmm. against someone better qualified than him, mm-hmm. reminded them of every businessman they'd come across in their careers, and they loathed him for it. That I hadn't thought of.
That, I hadn't thought of that either. That's very interesting. Stephen, I'm going to give you the last word or harangue or whatever you want to do. I was kidding about the harangue. Have you seen debates before? Have you followed American debates?
Yeah, I mean, I've watched basically pretty much every single presidential debate that's been here since 2000. The first one,
well,
I was talking about the 2001, that kind of mm-hmm. made the greatest impression of me because I listened to it and I thought, wow, Al Gore is absolutely walking away with this.
Yeah.
Bush is completely at sea.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that often it's not even the day of the debate that matters. It's the media narrative and the couple of days afterwards mm-hmm. that congeals in the public mm-hmm. mind that's important. So that's why, you know, campaigns make such an effort to set the tone, the narrative after the debate, mm-hmm. because it prevails for about a week afterwards.
All right, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Enterprise Reporter for CNN Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Mark Ferguson and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.